Committee on Energy and Environment will come to order. We have a packed agenda today, and hopefully lots of interest. We are going to start by opening a public hearing on House Bill 3448. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 3448 exempts diesel fuel to facilities from requirement to contain percentage of biodiesel or other diesel with renewable component, provided that that fuel is for emergency power generation.
And I'd like to call forward Julie Hanna, please. Sorry, or whoever you want. There's no amendment.
Okay.
Sorry, Roger Cole. I didn't quite have my sign-up sheet. Mr. Cole.
Thank you, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Roger Cole. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Health and Science University in support of House Bill 3448. I want to first thank Chair Bailey and Vice Chair Boone for their support and assistance in working with us on House Bill 3448 to ensure that if there were significant power outage, life-saving medical equipment and emergency communications would be maintained. You might remember this issue discussed during the public hearing of House Bill 2860, which I testified in support of. House Bill 3448 would provide an exemption from the state biodiesel requirements for facilities that store more than 50 gallons of diesel fuel for use in emergency power generation. While House Bill 2860 was an exemption exclusively for hospital facilities and long-term care facilities, we are bringing you House Bill 3448 because it better tackles the issues that have been identified with long-term storage of large amounts of diesel for use in emergency generators at facilities that provide life-saving services. Rather than trying to call out in statute each entity that must operate in an emergency power outage for life-saving reasons, House Bill 3448 ensures that all facilities that provide life-saving resources would be exempt from the current state biodiesel requirement. OHSU currently stores very large amounts of fuel to support emergency generators for power outages and as backup fuel supply for steam boilers that provide heat to our campus. While hospitals are required under federal regulations to store enough fuel to maintain power continuously for 96 hours, the requirements vary among long-term care facilities. Therefore, a 50-gallon threshold amount was the most appropriate to ensuring life-saving equipment continues to maintain power in an emergency. Emergency fuel supplies and generator tanks are never totally consumed. They are maintained to be always at the ready to support patient care and research functions in emergency situations. The fuel supply may take years to be completely replaced. The challenges for facilities that must continuously operate during an emergency power outage is that biofuels have a limited shelf life, even in optimum conditions. House Bill 3448 would ensure that hospitals, long-term care facilities, and emergency communications will provide continuous life-saving services without risking malfunction of emergency diesel generators due to the deterioration of fuel from long-term storage. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Colleagues, you'll recall House Bill 2860, it had a relating to clause issue, and Representative Boone was kind enough to draft this bill as a replacement with her priority bill. This bill now covers a larger group of entities, and I think will hopefully be a more widely acceptable solution to the problem. I think it's worth noting that although this bill does not mention specifically facilities that store diesel for emergency power generation, the intent, I think, here is to cover entities such as hospitals, long-term care facilities, and broadcasters like Oregon Public Broadcasting. So hopefully we have got that solved. Questions for this witness? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and probably for purposes of avoiding confusion later, perhaps you could tell us more clearly exactly what the term power generation means as it's intended to be used in that line 30. It's not a trick question. I just want you to say for the record what that is. So my diesel truck is a power generator, and so is that what this means, or is there something else going on with this language?
This would come from a power outage at a facility due to a natural disaster, power bump, in which we have life-saving equipment that relies on that power to be used.
Are we taking follow-up?
Yeah. You mean electrical power generation?
Electrical power generation, correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Sorry. Thank you, Representative. Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3448 and open a work session on House Bill 3448. Representative Johnson.
Chair Bailey, I move House Bill 3448 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Johnson moves House Bill 3448 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there objection to the motion? Seeing none, motion carries. Going to the floor, we will assign Representative Boone to carry and close. It's her priority bill.
Not just that she's not here.
Okay. I promise to be here on time every time.
We had one for you. Right? It will close the work session on House Bill 3448 and open an informational meeting on the carbon tax report. Mr. Patowski, you and whoever from your team.
Good afternoon, Chair Bailey, members of the House Energy and Environment Committee. For the record, my name is Tom Patowski. I am a faculty member at Portland State University and director of the Northwest Economic Research Center. Also with me today from NERC, easy to remember, one letter away from NERD, is Jeff Renfro, senior economist with the Northwest Economic Research Center. We're here, we'll very quickly provide you with information about a carbon tax study that we just completed. Real quickly on some background, we won't get into the particulars about the fossil fuel burning and what it causes for greenhouse gases and so on and so forth. Just wanted you to know that what we feel about a carbon tax is that, one, it provides a price now on something that has no price, so that it becomes part of the cost of doing business, and as such is then more efficiently regarded, and its use is more efficient in the sense of possibly less use. But also a carbon tax in the full design has something called a double dividend. And very, very broadly, what we mean by this is that here is the sort of process that you want to follow. You want to tax the things that you don't want, and you want to lower taxes on the things you do want. And what this design of a carbon tax allows you to do then is to tax the things you don't want, possibly the certain burning of fossil fuels that have carbon content, and you can turn around and use that tax money to lower the taxes on things that cause disincentive effects, be it corporate taxes, personal income taxes, and so forth. And so this is sort of the double dividend. You reduce the carbon emissions, you then also reduce possible taxes that have disincentive effects on doing business and in household spending. We know the state has a goal of reaching 10% below 1990 levels by 2020, rather ambitious goal. And then the other aspect with the carbon tax is, besides being what we might call tax neutral, in that you just repatriate back all the taxes, it has the possibility of actually increasing revenues for the state. It all is involved in the tax design of how this thing operates. Revenue repatriation offsets competitiveness burden in the sense that if a business has a tax placed upon it because it is using carbon content type materials, you can lower the corporate income taxes on that business to help mitigate that impact and help them keep that business being competitive with other businesses. Now, I'm not going to go into all of these. We're going to talk about these as we go along, but I think I have about 10 minutes, so I want to make sure that we get to the meat of this matter.
Great.
Our tax study is patterned after British Columbia's carbon tax. They have a cap on a metric ton of $30 per ton of CE2 equivalents. They've generated revenues. They've seen decreases in emissions. Of course, they instituted in 2008, not the best of economic times. And the BC economy did shrink a little bit, but it did not shrink as much as other Canadian provinces. And also, it was turning out growing a little bit faster than other provinces in Canada in 2011. So initial research really shows that at least the carbon tax in British Columbia did no harm, at least, to the economy. Our modeling. very quickly. We use what's called an extended policy baseline. My analogy here is the cigarette taxes. Think about the cigarette taxes. We have ads. We have, you know, you see the side of the bus, Bob with his one lung. You know, we have laws about not smoking in public places. I believe the Senate just the other day passed a resolution about smoking in cars with children. And the other thing we have in terms of decreasing smoking is a cigarette tax. Now, take that analogy to greenhouse gas emissions. We have the CAFE standards, we have a clean fuels program, consumer energy efficiency requirements. We've got all these things in place. The one thing that we don't have, unlike the cigarette tax, is a tax on the item itself. And so it really puts together then just the full package of what we're looking at. So we have this extended policy baseline in that we look and believe all these things to clean the air is in place and will stay in place. And then what would be the difference if we added a carbon tax on top of that? What would be the impact? We use a model called CTAM. All that's doing is trying to look at if I increase the price of something, what's the usage of it? And so it's looking at a sensitivity to putting this tax on, and the outcomes of this model are what are the greenhouse gas emissions that occur, there should be reductions, and then also what revenue gets generated because you have the tax. Then lastly, we have IMPLAN, which is a economic impact modeling. These are the areas that we're looking at, residential, industrial, commercial, and transportation. I just want you to look at the two pie charts on the right-hand side. This gives you a sense that, you know, most of the employment, the jobs that we're looking at, is in what's called the commercial side. This is a catch-all. All the service industries are in there. The industrial has about 16% of the employment. These are your manufacturing, traded sectors, agricultural, natural resources. Residential, about 6%. These are businesses all involved in dealing with home energy usage, residential construction, and so forth. And then transportation has a very small amount. And these are everything dealing with motor vehicle transportation, shipping, transportation of all means. But the bottom one shows that that's the sector that has the largest content of CO2e equivalent emissions. So likewise, when you set up a tax, that's the sector as defined here that's going to have the largest tax burden because they have the most CO2 emissions. And then the other ones are sort of equally distributed. So very quickly, this is what British Columbia has in place, $30 maximum. The blue line is business as usual. So that's if I have all the clean air processes, laws in place, that's what would be the outcome, the forecast of where greenhouse emissions would be in that diagram. The red line says, if I institute a carbon tax, what will be the outcome? You might see just off to the left here, it dips down, then dips back up. We're still dealing with the recession, so you start to have some items that greenhouse gas emissions still come down because lower economic activity, and you're starting to add a tax. Then you have economic activity bouncing back, and so you have a little bit stronger use of greenhouse gas emissions, and then finally it starts to dissipate. The green line down below is the 1990 standards. You've got to go a long ways if you're going to reach that standard by having a $30 carbon tax. With $60, and this is going to be our recommended amount, shows that you get down a little bit farther. The top part of the diagram in the chart shows the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that are reduced and how far you have to go to reach those 1990. The bottom part of that chart shows the amount of revenues generated. And so you can see that in 2015, these are annual amounts, it's about $1.173 billion that would be generated in that year from this tax. If you go all the way to 100, this allows you to reach those standards of 1990. It's pretty dramatic. From our viewpoint, we think this is maybe a little too dramatic at the moment. Possibly over time, we might be able to institute this. But we like the $60 about the best. So what I'm going to go into a couple of scenarios here. We have some boundaries where we take a look and say, what if you put the carbon tax in, you get certain revenues back because of that. What if you repatriate it all to businesses in the corporate income tax? Or don't do that, put it all back to households and give it to them. And this is an issue of efficiency versus equity. And we think these two boundary cases show that I'm going to get the most job creation if I put this in and give the corporate and the businesses all the money back from the carbon tax. This is where the jobs are generated. But households are left holding the bag in this sense. They don't get anything back. Now, if you give it all back to households, this likely will mean a slight decrease in jobs, but it's more equitable on that household level. So we think that you won't want to give up one or the other. There's a nice combination in between here of a degree of efficiency and a degree of equity that you can have. And then down below, we also have ones that say, don't give all of it back. Hold back 10%, hold back 25%, and reinvest it in certain areas in the economy. So 60 maximum price, this gives you what the revenues would be generated, tax revenues. To give you some context, in 2015, it'd be about 15% of the annual general fund and lottery revenues. So it is a considerable amount. And then what would be the emissions down below? Now, what we do is we take that and try to see, well, what's going to be the effect on economic activity based on this tax and then repatriating some of the taxes back. So what we have, if you get it all back to businesses, you get the largest job increases, but it's extremely regressive on households. What we find, especially in low-income households, their portion of their income, most of that is spent on items that have some sort of carbon content relationship to them. Now, if you give them all back to households, you have the most job losses that would occur. Now, if you give it all back to households, but you try to give some low-income household relief, you still have some job losses, and it's a little bit better than it was before, but still, we would not recommend this particular approach. So we think there's something better in between. And so the one in between that we have, the first one is if we give 70% back of that 1.7 in 2015, 1.7 billion back to businesses, give 20% of it back to households with low income relief, and then hold back 10% for maybe energy efficiency projects. For example, those businesses that are affected mostly by the carbon tax, assist them in changing their production process around so that they lower their usage of carbon content items. This gives you some of the effect here. You can see that the transportation area is the one sector hit the hardest. Commercial is helped the most. A little negative on the industrial and slightly positive on the household. And keep in mind, where we're talking about the total effect here, 2015, 2,787 jobs. If you're looking at about 1.6 million jobs total of employment in Oregon, you're down to only, what is about 2%? Of the job, or less than that? Less than 1%. Yes, my math is not very good this afternoon. Less than 1% of all the jobs. So, positive impact here, but I think the real story is you're not hurting the economy. If instead we do the other approach where it's 25% reinvestment, 50% to businesses, 25% to households, and then 25% can be provided for extra tax credits, for example, for houses, industrial energy efficiency, transportation infrastructure, or other means that you might want. So, and this is the scenario here. Once again, still positive job growth, but that's now it's even less because we gave a little less back to the businesses in terms of repatriating the taxes. And so, once again, something below 1% change in jobs, but not a view that it hurts the economy. So we think there's definitely with reducing carbon emissions, there's a way to design the tax, both the tax, what it is, and the repatriation of the taxes back that can potentially be helpful to the Oregon economy. Significant revenue generating potential, reinvestment in public works, investing in clean energy projects are possible. We can affect the low income problem and provide them with some support so that they're not as regressive. And I'll just, we've already talked about these other two items. We really think there's further research needed in this area. And the one that is going to be somewhat difficult is sort of the design of import duties. Because if you institute a tax here, what about a company that makes the same thing that's outside of our borders, is not to face the tax? They have a competitive advantage against the company in Oregon. So somewhere we would then have to have a process by which the carbon content items that are produced outside the state that are brought in are taxed. Likewise, if something is produced here that has a carbon content, is exported out of the state, and that it's used or combusted outside of us, is not going to cause a greenhouse gas emission here. So that is exempt from the tax. You tax the imports, you exempt the exports, is one aspect. And that's our presentation. Is this the last slide? Okay.
Thank you very much. It's a very interesting...
A lot in a little time.
That's sort of the... motto of this building. Questions for this witness? Representative Whitsitt.
I'm sorry if I missed it. Could you tell us from all industrial sources and cars, how much carbon is emitted per year in Oregon by ton?
I think we may have that at our fingertips here.
So, for the record, I'm Jeff Renfro.
Thank you.
It's 70% of 45 million tons. So, if anyone can help me with the math there, I'll say that's roughly 30, 35 million.
Okay. Could I follow up?
Please.
This will take a minute. Do you know how much carbon particulate in the 10 micron category is produced by an acre of forest consumed by a forest fire? I'll tell you if you don't know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, please tell us.
Okay. According to the EPA, 25 to 40 pounds is produced per ton of wood fuel burnt. Using a 20-pound average, the Biscuit Fire of 2002 of 500,000 acres with 20 tons of fuel per acre consumed 3 million pounds essentially produced of carbon. In 2007, wildfires scorched 750,000 acres in Oregon, producing an estimated 4.5 million pounds of carbon. And EPA states that forest fires nationally from 2000 to 2005 produced 562 million tons of carbon. So I think that we need to look at perhaps the burning of our forests through lack of proper forest policies first, in my opinion, to control our carbon input into the air of the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This extremely interesting report, and the challenge, I suppose, for us, because the area is so complex, is to ask a decent question, so I hope this is one. But you seem to offset the income of the carbon from a carbon tax against the income tax. And is that what British Columbia, I was just going online here and checking their experience, and it appeared that it was more or less neutral. From the few years that they've had it, but did they take the money that was raised by the carbon tax from those that were burning fuel and move it over and offset and drive down the income tax? Is that what they did? And that is that? Did your study then suggest that offsetting the income tax is the best or most neutral way of going about this type of a trade out?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, yes, exactly. British Columbia did do that, using the tax from the tax revenues from the carbon and offsetting both income taxes and corporate business taxes. And the idea here is that and they have a fairly broad-based as who the carbon tax was applied to, rather than exempting certain industries from it, because they felt that you want to sort of divorce the price you put on the carbon and the repatriated amount back in another form where you're lowering costs of doing business. Because you want that price signal still to work so that you move away from it. But yes, essentially, in terms of the economic activity in the state, fairly neutral to maybe slightly positive, but their approach was to try to make that a almost tax neutral, in that I gain the tax on this side from the carbon tax, I lower the business and household taxes.
Yeah, follow up,
please.
Thank you. The challenge is, as you just put it, working the offset in a way that doesn't negate the hoped for impact of the higher price of the carbon-based product. What about this shift of cost, if you will, that occurs? In other words, the parties bearing the burden of the higher tax then wouldn't necessarily be those who are paying it. It would be those who maybe supply carbon-based fuel are suddenly bearing. They take a hit as a result of this reduced burning of carbon-based fuels. Who is it that comes in then and absorbs that loss? Is it that's just too bad for them?
Well, Representative Bentz, we have in the study and the way we modeled it, we do recognize that there's going to be some shifting of the tax burden, either through raising prices, so that a company that is, say, a trucking transportation company may be raising some of their fees in order to try to cover that tax. So that, though, will slow their business down. Because they're doing that, because they're more expensive, the price went up. But on the other hand, if you can repatriate back some of the taxes, and thus lower some of their other costs of doing business, like their corporate taxes, that may offset that problem. And Jeff, do you want to add to this?
Representative Bentz, we think that there's certainly going to be winners and losers in this. The reason that we recommend a scenario where we save some of the revenues for targeted reinvestment is in BC they found that doing mostly corporate income and doing personal income tax cuts keeps the overall economic benefit the most neutral. But you can take that extra money and you can target it at industries that could be negatively affected that are important to the Oregon economy, and you can assist them in converting their business to a more and less energy intensity or less energy intense version.
Mm-hmm. Please, yeah,
right. And it seems to, and this gets us to a. I've noticed in the time I've been here, which has been short, that our experience in investing the state's money in business is mixed, and so the outcome is mixed. The challenge would be, to go back to my question, Dr. Potowski, was we're going to force the buying of less fuel by virtue of this tax. So those who are selling it are going to be in some way negatively impacted. And my question there was, too bad for them, apparently. There's no offset for that. That's just, they're just in the wrong business. And we move over and take the but you can correct me if I am incorrect on that aspect of the question. But the other point of our taking that money that we've now taken by virtue of the carbon tax, and then we here figure out how to invest it, bothers me because we haven't been that good at it. Maybe you can share with us how well that's worked for the people of British Columbia. And you can answer the first question also, because I am interested in knowing if that's even taken into account, or should it be, given our approach, which is to try to drive down overall consumption of fuel.
So Representative Bentz, sellers of fuel, the impact is going to vary very greatly depending on the type of fuel being sold. So anyone involved in the wholesale of coal, I can't imagine a scenario in which you're able to fully offset that. Someone selling natural gas, the tax applied to natural gas in the version of the tax we're using is going to be significantly less than the coal example, so it could be offset. So could you repeat the second half?
I mean, Mr. Chair, it's the investment. It's our taking the money from folks and then figuring out which companies we're going to benefit with that funding stream?
Absolutely. So, Representative Benz, in our modeling, we do see a loss of economic efficiency or lower positive job impacts when we do set aside more of the money for reinvestment. So, yes, I think that that is a danger to try to pick winners or to target the investment at specific industries. It would be more, it would have greater overall economic impacts if you did just do a neutral tax cut for corporations. In our report, we model it as being something like an expansion of clean energy works type programs, where it's not directly given to an industry, but there are opportunities for industries to take advantage of these funds to change their business practices.
And if I, do you mind if I have a friendly clarification?
Yeah,
so if I recall from your slide presentation, in your optimal model, the bulk of it was directed at these sort of broad-based tax offsets so that it's essentially industry neutral, and you'd reserved a smaller portion, I think it was 10% or something, for reinvestment. And was that to assess a trade-off between larger economic efficiency and distributional inequities? Is that the case?
Yes, Chair Bailey. That's exactly it. In British Columbia, they put most of the revenue towards these tax rate cuts, but then they have set aside some money for things like the agricultural sector because of high energy intensity. Pretty serious international competition is potentially an industry that could be affected. So they set aside some of the money for additional property tax breaks for agricultural land. They also set aside some money for additional relief for low-income BC residents.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The one point that you mentioned that was a challenge is the fact that Oregon is Oregon, and if it chose to approach it in this fashion, would have a challenge when it comes to surrounding states and pricing. Is there any solution to that, or is that does that mean that we impose upon the businesses in Oregon this higher cost that then causes flight, for example, where I am, over into Idaho to avoid this carbon tax, or wherever else? What's the solution, if any, to that?
Representative Benz, it's on two folds. One is that by repatriating back some of the tax to these industries, we hope to, even though one part of their business cost went up because of the tax, some other part of the business tax comes down. So hopefully that keeps them somewhat neutral. But there's probably going to be some in, say, the transportation area that won't be neutral and they'll actually be hurt. They just don't pay in enough taxes to have it repatriated back. So there's other things like the reinvestments that maybe can help that industry. The other side to it is a investigation into import tariffs in the idea that, now I shouldn't say tariffs, but in that if something is produced outside the state, a coal electricity generation, and that electricity is piped, you know, into the state, that should be taxed because it's being used here. So that's one way to tie it. If I've got a company here and a cement company here and a cement company across in Treasure Valley and in Idaho, and they have a competitive advantage, the tax would apply to them if they're bringing products into the state.
Sort of like if I'm a Washington resident and I come to Oregon to buy a car and take it back to Washington, I have to pay sales tax when I register in Washington.
Yes.
Got it. And I'm curious, your modeling on the economics of it, what does that assume for the effect of carbon and the cost of carbon on the climate?
Oh, go ahead.
In our Chair Bailey, in our slides, we show a decrease in emissions. We don't translate that to a direct effect on environmental outcomes. But at the $60 per ton in 2025, I think it's a 15% decrease in emissions below the forecasted baseline.
So would it be correct to say then that the positive economic impacts that you forecast from this tax, from the shifting of the tax and the reinvestment, are exclusive of any assumption about the environmental effects of carbon? that the economic effects stand alone. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you. Representative Peterson.
Okay, so thank you so much, Chair, and thank you for being here. So this is a really interesting concept, and I agree with Representative Bentz that it's incumbent on us to ask the good questions. So I want to make sure I'm understanding this clearly. So let's say that, you know, the transportation sector has the most carbon kind of use right now. So let's say that there's a hauling company in Oregon that would have the carbon tax applied to them. And they're in direct competition, let's say, with a hauling company from California who would not have this tax, and we wouldn't have any way to really tax that company. If they were both up for the same job, it would put the Oregon company at a disadvantage with this. So how has that been dealt with in British Columbia, or has it?
Representative Patterson, specifically on trucking, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I would say when we've talked to people in British Columbia who've been in charge of implementing the tax, because they're still at $30 per ton, that's just not a high enough price to impose really serious competitiveness issues. They have the cement industry there. I know has there have been some complaints from them. One thing that they have done, though, is I think we failed to mention so far that this is potentially an economic development tool. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the businesses that are going to be negatively affected, but there are going to be a lot of businesses in Oregon that are positively affected that are going to be more competitive. So you are going to have some firms, most likely in the transportation sector, is going to be negatively affected. You can choose to use some of this money to offset those negative effects, or you just focus more on the big picture and look for overall gains in the Oregon economy.
Thank you. Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Petoskey, when you started today, I think you made a statement, something to the effect that carbon or fossil fuel specifically or something, and have no price built into them. Did I hear you correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. Yes, in the sense that...
I guess I would just say, as I go to the pump...
No.
There's definitely some cost factors, i.e. taxes, built into those.
And I should more correctly have said that it is the emissions that are given off from the use of those fossil fuels. There is no price to that. And the carbon tax is an attempt to put a price onto it.
I guess I would say that as the cost of that commodity, whatever it be, whether it's natural gas or coal or fuel, increases, it does deter usage by and large because it costs more.
Yes.
So there is a deterrent factor built into the market already in terms of consumption.
Well, Representative Johnson, yes. I ride the MAX in to Portland State, and when the price of gasoline goes up, I have to stand on the MAX. I mean, definitely people behave to it. And this is then, those prices go up and down based on economic conditions, oil, you know, supplies, all these other things. There's a terrorist attack, whatever. The carbon tax adds a premium on top of that. So the estimate is something like 50 cents or something per gallon.
55.
About 55 cents would be at a $60 per ton, would add about 55 cents per gallon. And yes, that is a deterrent. What do you do about that deterrent? If I have my household budget, I go, geez, I have to go to work, I have to pay now more for gasoline because of this carbon tax, but my income taxes are being reduced. So in my overall budget, I'm maybe not going to be hurt as bad. But even though my you know, cost of living has gone up, I may be going to be helped because I can have a drop in my income taxes.
Paul? Which would seem to be pretty speculative on the part of the government to be determining what's in the best interest of the consumer. We're forcing them into a different posture, into a different position, i.e. getting rid of this, moving into this posture, and we're deeming that to be more favorable for the whole. So I guess that's what I'm uncomfortable with, a little bit of that societal micromanagement. Just one more point.
Please.
You made a statement that I totally agree with, in that we tax things that we don't want, which I think as we look at our state's tax structure, a state that's relying upon income taxes for the majority of our general fund revenue, it doesn't make a lot of sense that we do have such a high personal income tax. So I would hope you might take that philosophy into the House Revenue Committee, too, as they're beginning to consider some of the revenue-enhancing measures and say, keep that in mind. If we want more of something, let's not tax it more. So thank you.
I think that may be one of the principles behind the there testimony today. Representative Dembrough.
I know, just following up on Rep. Johnson's point, I mean, I think that that is really one of the fundamental goals here is to get people to change their behavior as far as, you know, using alternative public transportation when that's possible to create greater incentives for ride sharing and, you know, to make those changes in their behavior. The goal here is to have, if we all agree that we want to reduce carbon emissions and reduce global warming, that's in our interest as a society, then how do we get there? And it seems like this is an attempt to have us get there in a way that will be not onerous in the long run on the individuals, because there are opportunities for various kinds of savings through other areas of the tax code. I mean, that seems to be the basic principle.
I think that's one of the issues under discussion. One more briefly, and we need to move on to other bills.
I'm a little bit uncomfortable with what seemed like a very high degree of centralized control. Maybe it's, you know, readings as a teenager. But did you look at other alternatives where we could accomplish maybe the same thing more through free market forces rather than such a high degree of centralized control? Or is there an alternative that you looked at?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reardon, we in our report did not make a sort of like a comparison to, say, the cap and trade approach to this also, which is another way. But I would say this is fairly market oriented in a way, in that you're giving a price signal out to the market. And you're basically saying that if we believe, as Representative Dembrough said, that these fossil fuels that are consumed, these greenhouse emissions, there is a cost out there that we collectively pay for. Mm-hmm. And what we're trying to do is internalize that cost into where it's actually used to reduce its usage, and trying to use market forces to do it. I sympathize definitely with. I don't think that the government is the best in controlling our behaviors, and in this sense, what we're doing with the government is trying to give a signal out to the market, and in that way is allowing the market to make all the behavioral changes. The government is not saying thou shall not use this fuel this way. Let's let the market do it and properly, in my mind, put a price on these things.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much. We appreciate you coming down and the hard work you did on this report. It's a lot of food for thought, and we'll continue to chew on it. So thank you.
Thank you.
We will close the informational hearing, and we are going to back up for a second and do a few motions and business items here. Do I need to reopen the work session for 3448? Reopen a work session on House Bill 3448. Representative Boone.
Mr. Chair, I request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow me to be recorded as voting aye on the motion to pass House Bill 3448 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. It will not change the outcome of the vote taken.
Representative Boone requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow her to be recorded as voting aye on the motion to pass House Bill 3448 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. It will not change the outcome. This motion is not debatable. If there is no objection, so ordered. Close the work session on House Bill 3448. Open work session on House Bill 2516. colleagues, you'll remember House Bill 2516 from a meeting or two ago. We had a lot of good testimony on the bill, and I think it's fair to say that we have reached a point where there is, I think, a lot of agreement, I won't say unanimous agreement, but a lot of agreement that it's a good program that needs to find some sort of funding source. And also, I think, fairly wide agreement that, at least from some, that there is challenges in the bill as written with the funding source. And Ways and Means has requested to be able to take a look at the funding source in the bill, be able to come up with alternatives. And it is my feeling that the policy questions in this bill have generally been answered, and this is more of a Ways and Means funding discussion. So I would like to move this to Ways and Means without recommendation for passage. Without recommendation will be the motion. Representative Boone.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2516 to the floor without recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Ways and Means Committee by prior reference.
Representative Boone moves House Bill 2516 to the floor without recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to vote for the referral and for the bill, but I want to join you in saying I don't want to put words in your mouth. I want it clear as a bell that I would not in any way support the funding of this program from the source identified in the bill. So I'm very happy for the without recommendation. And I think I mentioned during the hearing my concern about the possible bias of some of the classes that are offered. I've never attended outdoor school. Many of you have. So you're in a better position to say whether or not my fear is true. But I'm hopeful that having raised the issue, it might have some impact, positive, I hope, on the care we have to take in educating our kids about the value of things having to do with other than the environment. That is work and logging and mining and all of the other stuff we do to pay our bills. So I think I've done as much as I can do with that assertion at this level, and I'll support the motion.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Reardon.
Thank you, Chair. I would also like to echo Representative Benz's comments that I totally support outdoor school, but I would not support and would hope that there would be no funding taken from the current programs.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you. Representative Whitsitt.
I echo the sentiments of my colleagues.
Thank you, Representative. Please call the roll.
Representative Whitsitt?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Excused.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Reardon?
Aye.
Representative Dembro?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Chair
Bailey. Aye. Motion carries. It's on to Ways and Means. Thank you, colleagues. And open a work session on House Bill 2435. Adam, we have amendments. Is that correct?
We do, Chair Bailey. House Bill 2435 exempts from fuel excise tax diesel fuel blended with at least 20% biodiesel used from derived from used cooking oil. The exemption does not apply to fuel used in motor vehicles with a gross vehicle weight of 10,000 pounds or more. It applies to fuel sold after January 1st, 2014 and before January 1st, 2020. It takes effect 91 days after signing die. The Dash 3 amendment raises the exemption from motor vehicles from 10,000 to 26,001 pounds. There has been a impact statement issued along with a minimal fiscal impact statement issued. It has a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Revenue, and the Dash 3 amendments are attached with your SMS.
Colleagues, I want to thank on the record the Department of Transportation. They have done great work since the hearing to help us really understand what the fiscal and revenue cost of this bill would be. Significantly lower and significantly less cumbersome than first anticipated because of some really good due diligence work on their part to really understand the scope of the bill and its intention. This bill has a long path and will have its revenue impact examined in the Revenue Committee, where several of you sit, and if for whatever reason it comes out of that committee, then it will be on to Ways and Means, where it will have its fiscal implications examined. So it is my intention to send it on its torturous path through this body, and God bless it as it goes. Representative Boone.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -3 amendments dated March 11th, 2013.
Representative Boone moves to adopt the -3 amendments dated March 11th, 2013. Discussion. Representative Boone.
Well, I just want to thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to let you know that...
Is this on the amendment or on the bill?
It's on the bill.
Can we save for the motion on the bill?
Oh, right. Okay,
great.
Sorry.
Thanks. Discussion on the amendment. Hearing none, amendment is adopted. Representative Boone, your motion on the bill.
Okay, Mr. Chair, move that House Bill 2435 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and the bill be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Representative Boone moves House Bill 2435 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Now, Representative Boone, discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize for being late to this committee and popping in and out. I've had a big meeting in my other committee that ran quite a bit over and was introducing the resilience plan. And one of the things that came out of it is that what's going to happen to the fuel in the fuel tanks once the Cascadia event occurs. And we are going to now need some sort of fuel for our vehicles, et cetera. On the other side of the hill, and so I would like you to make sure that that's part of your future work, that you get some of this French fry oil stuff over there so we can fuel our generators and our vehicles.
We'll note that for the record. Thank you.
And that was serious.
I'm not taking that as not being serious. I hear you full well. Further discussion. Representative Benz.
Chair, I appreciate all of your effort on this bill. I also appreciate your excellent efforts on the Committee on Tax Credits, and this is one of those things that I am thinking provides an opportunity for those who are in this business to enjoy an additional amount that they don't need to be engaged in what they're doing already, and therefore I'll be a no vote here and happy to consider it further because I will get to see it again at revenue, but I'm a no vote this afternoon.
Thank you. All right, please call the roll.
Representative Benz.
No.
Representative Denbrough.
Yes.
Representative Reardon.
Yes.
Representative Megan Peterson.
Yes.
Representative Wagner.
Excused.
Representative Whitsitt.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Boone.
Aye.
Chair Bailey.
Aye. And motion carries. It's on its way. Close the work session on House Bill 2435. Open a work session on House Bill 2694. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 2694 requires the Oregon Department of State Lands to study issues related to the development of energy resources in Oregon's territorial sea. It requires the study to include issues relating to sharing of territorial sea mapping information generated by entities developing energy resources and fees paid by developers of energy resources to be used to pay costs relating to the Oregon State University's territorial sea mapping project. It requires the study to be given to the Legislative Assembly on or before November 1st, 2013, repeals the measure on January 2nd, 2015, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage. There are two amendments attached to this. Amendment 1 replaces the measure. It requires any entity developing energy resources in Oregon's territorial sea to share any mapping information with Oregon State University's territorial sea mapping project. It allows the director of the Department of State Lands to adopt rules or take action necessary to implement the process, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage. There is a -2 amendment as well. It also replaces the measure and incorporates the Dash 1 amendment. It adds specificity to mapping information entities developing energy resources need to share with Oregon State University's Territorial Sea Mapping Project to include geological and geophysical data, including bathymetry, backscatter, seismic reflection, and sample data. There is no revenue impact nor a fiscal impact.
All right, committee will stand at ease for a moment. What are we doing?
Doing the Dash 2.
Dash 2.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's great.
Do you have a motion?
I do. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated March 13th, 2013.
Representative Boone moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated March 13th, 2013. Is there discussion? Is there objection to the amendments? Amendments are adopted. Representative Boone?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2694 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boone moves House Bill 2694 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to clarify it for those of you in the audience and up at the dais. The Dash 2 expanded on the Dash 1, which replaced the whole bill. But what this does is it cleared everything up. Everybody's on board. Nobody is offended. Nobody is
probably
opposing
true also.
It. We're all offended, yeah. And this is a good thing. This helps get the data to the right place, and it actually won't cost money to the state, so it's one of those good things. Should pass.
Further discussion? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just had a question in reviewing this and building on Representative Boone's remarks about the cost. The amendment indicates that the director of the Department of State Lands may adopt rules or take any other action, and I'm understanding that whatever that is, it's something that department is okay with and can manage within their current budget.
That's correct, Representative.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, is there objection to the motion? Seeing none, motion carries. Representative Boone, would you like to carry?
I'd be happy to.
That's a double dose today. Yeah. All right. Well, we will close the work session on House Bill 2694. And as I shuffle through my papers here. Okay. Reopen the work session on House Bill 2516. Representative Whitsitt.
Chair Bailey, I request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow me to be recorded as voting nay on the motion, House Bill 2516. It will not change the outcome.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended in order to change her vote to nay on the motion to pass House Bill 2016 without recommendation to Committee on Ways and Means. It will not change the outcome. Any objection? Seeing none, motion carries. Close the work session on House Bill 2516. And open a work session on House Bill, open a public hearing on House Bill 2792. Adam, you can read the short version.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 2792 imposes a tax on each fuel supplier and utility based on the amount of carbon and carbon-based fuel that is sold by fuel suppliers to consumers in Oregon or that is used to produce carbon-generated electricity to consumers in the state. It limits the tax on certain oil and natural gas to 6% of the market value of oil or natural gas. It allows a credit against tax for creation of carbon, forestry carbon offsets, distributes proceeds of tax to State Highway Fund, Common School Fund, General Fund, Department of Energy, Department of Environmental Quality, Department of Land Conservation and Development, and Department of Education, repeals the Renewable Fuel Standard, Energy Siting Assessment, and provisions relating to the Renewable Portfolio Standards, changes the rate of the motor vehicle fuel tax, takes effect 91 days after signing die.
Representative Bailey, would you identify yourself and proceed?
Thank you, Vice Chair Johnson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jules Bailey. I have the pleasure of representing House District 42. Pleased to bring before you today House Bill 2792, which is the continuation of a conversation, returning to the discussion of a carbon tax. This is a bill that I had drafted prior to the Patowski report. I think the content of the bill could be greatly informed by the Patowski report. But it contains a concept that I wanted to put before the committee for the discussion of the members, and to point out a couple of policy questions that I think are worth discussion within this body. So first, a quick discussion of what House Bill 2792 does. House Bill 2792, you'll notice, has a blank in it for the amount of the carbon tax. It is up for discussion what the appropriate amount is. But in the course of that discussion, this bill is really about a question of trade-offs. Do we want a system that focuses on regulation, or do we want a system that focuses on market mechanisms, getting the prices right, and letting the market function? The bill also allows for an offset of tax liability of the carbon tax through purchases of forestry carbon offsets on Oregon forest lands. It has a proposed distribution of the funding. I would call that a rough sketch at best of where the dollars from the carbon tax might go. And it also does several things that I think are a bit controversial, but also worth being part of the discussion. It repeals the renewable portfolio standard. It repeals the energy supplier assessment. It repeals the low carbon fuel standard. It decreases the motor vehicle tax, and it repeals the renewable fuel standard. And what this bill attempts to say is, if we get the prices right, and it does not propose what the right price is, but if we were to get the prices right and use a market mechanism to achieve the same ends that we are trying to achieve through regulatory mechanisms, that would be a more efficient way of achieving our policy outcomes in this state than the regulatory mechanisms that we have that can be distortionary in the marketplace. Now, as I'm sure all of you know, Oregon has a myriad of tools which have been effective at their goals of job creation, energy security, and combating climate change. But regulation costs money, as everybody knows. That's not a partisan issue. Regulation costs money. And much of the discussion about regulation focuses on the trade-offs between the cost of regulation and the benefits that it provides. This bill attempts to say that there might be an easier way to do it. Any discussion of a tax is difficult, but the fact is that we are paying a tax, whether imputed or not, either way, and that by informing the market through a price on carbon, it may be a more efficient way of achieving those policy outcomes. Now, there are generally, as to back up a second, three ways to deal with an externality, with an unpriced component of our economy. One, you can impose a regulation. Two, you could fix a price on that externality. Or three, you could fix the quantity. For those of you that are remembering back to your Econ 101 and you think of your graph with price and quantity, you can hold price constant and let the quantity float with regard to that price. You can hold the quantity constant and let the price float with regards to that, or you can impose regulation. Much of what we've done is with regulation, and that does have a place, for example, with toxics or other places where we would want to be sure that we're getting the quantity and the distribution of that quantity exactly right. Regulation is a very effective mechanism. For things like carbon, evidence is that market mechanisms, like pricing, are a more efficient way of achieving our goals. Now, some might argue that that a quantity-based method like a cap-and-trade system might be more effective. My argument would be that at a state level, it's very difficult to make that work with all of the potential for leakage in a single state context and the difficulty in setting up a well-functioning market for those things. So a carbon tax, I believe, is the most efficient way at a state level that we can achieve our policy outcomes while generating revenue for the state and creating the kinds of economic outcomes that you heard from Mr. Patowski. So the fact is that the dollar amount to achieve the outcomes that the regulatory mechanisms that we have achieve is probably not small. But I believe that for our state to have a cogent conversation about what a substantive climate policy would mean, to set a model for the rest of the nation, and to generate the kinds of income, jobs, and economic return that we've heard about, this could be an effective model that would allow industry to operate with known rules of the game and to be able to work under a market that is efficiently operating and is non-distortionary. And with that, I will pause and take any questions.
Any questions?
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill. It's an extremely interesting set of concepts. Do you have a list of the cost of the regulations that are being offset, that are in this, or, I'm sorry, being taken away and replaced with the carbon tax that in some fashion we can take a look at and see?
Apples to apples, right.
Yeah,
Vice Chair Johnson, Representative Benz, that's a great question. I don't have that list. It's extremely difficult and somewhat subjective to produce a list to understand the diffuse costs of those of regulation. That's actually part of the reason for this bill, is that it is difficult to get a sense of truly what the imputed cost or value of those regulations are within the economy, and that a pricing mechanism would be more transparent in exactly what people are paying. I think it's an excellent question. I don't have that list, but I'd be happy to look into some research to see if there's some at least guesses that are out there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In lieu of receiving payment, a non-federal forest landowner may elect to claim a credit against the tax otherwise due. Can you elaborate on that concept?
Vice Chair Johnson, Representative Benz, I'll tell you what the intention was. The language may be garbled a bit in the bill. The intention of that was that, as we all know, trees, when they grow, suck carbon dioxide out of the air, and as long as they aren't cut down or decomposed, keep that carbon within the wood. And so there's a value in our forests of taking carbon out of the air. And one of the things we do very well in this state is grow trees. And to recognize that, one could purchase forestry carbon offsets, for which there's already an established market. In fact, many private landowners within Oregon already participate in carbon offset markets through national exchanges. What this would say is you could sign essentially a long-term contract with a private landowner to sort of reserve a stand of timber, or to manage it in a certain way that would provide a long-term carbon benefit that then could be counted against your carbon tax revenue. So it might be more efficient to offset through that means than to reduce your carbon use. So that's the intention there.
I see. Thank you.
Senator Boone, did you have a question?
I did. Just quick. Thanks, Mr. Chair. This is just such a jewels bill. I haven't read it, but just this little sheet that we've got here. So thank you for bringing it up, and I'm going to read it tonight when I get it printed out. But I think he pretty much covered a couple of mine. I was wondering about the amounts and what we have now, and how you do this. Would a timber company, for example, who had a sale and wanted to cut as part of their timber, could buy it from somebody who had a forest land in a small woodland or something like that, and then take those? Is that what this is?
Vice Chair Johnson, Vice Chair Boone, there are national and international standards for how to account for carbon in a forestry setting. I'm not an expert on how those credits get created, but there are credits that are created through management decisions around forest land. And so you could imagine a scenario in which, just hypothetically, a utility, and I'm not naming any particular utility, I'm just making a hypothetical example. Let's say there was a utility that had a high carbon output from a generation source, but it was a very important generation source, and it would have cost them a lot of money to change the fuel or to reduce that carbon amount. So rather than paying the tax on that, it might be more efficient for them to purchase the credits from a forest owner to offset that carbon amount. You see the carbon savings either way, but the question is which one is more cost-effective. So it's a little bit of a safety valve to help reduce some of the cost of regulation, potentially.
A quick follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
So is it kind of like the, it's just another exchange, and I'm just trying to think how you'd go about it. Is it like the Land Conservancy? Is it kind of like that one, where you pay someone to not do something with their land?
Vice Chair Johnson, Vice Chair Boone, that's probably somewhat analogous. Sort of, you could think of it a bit like mitigation banking, kind of.
Yeah.
But I'd be happy to get you more information on it.
Okay, yeah. Thanks.
Representative Dimmer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Rep Bailey, I appreciate your being honest about the complexity of doing this. I'm thinking particularly about the, calculating the savings, the carbon reductions that we're already experiencing thanks to the programs that are in place, right? We would need to, if this program were to replace those, we would need to figure out what the offset is there.
Correct.
Right? Do you have any kind of sense, or do we know how much we're saving? Do we get an annual audit, as it were, of the savings from each of these programs, so that we could then figure out just how high that price would have to be in order to do a complete offset?
Vice Chair Johnson, Representative Dembro. We have some ideas. You heard some of them in the Petoskey report about what it would take to get to 1990 levels. The fact is, to be frank, some of it is guesswork, because you're trying to anticipate what, mm-hmm. how the market will respond. Not to get too into the weeds, but it's going to be different for different parts of the carbon-intensive uses of our economy. There's different elasticities with regards to price. So in the transportation sector, there's not a lot of alternatives, right? So people are going to, it takes a large price to get a larger price to get a reduction than it might, say, in a electricity sector, where there's ability to go out and purchase renewable credits on the market, or however you want to structure it. So I want to be clear and say that I support the Renewable Portfolio Standard. I think it's done great things for Oregon. I think the evidence is there. I support the Low Carbon Fuel Standard. I think it's done great things for Oregon, and we'll continue to have a conversation about that. I think the benefits of those are such that we would need to have a very cogent conversation about what the right price is before taking a step like this. But in theory, in principle, it is true that we could achieve those same outcomes more efficiently through a pricing mechanism rather than through regulatory mechanisms that may not always be spot on with what the economy, how the economy functions. Mm-hmm. So we need to put in a lot of work to answer your question succinctly, to figure out exactly what that price is. We have some ideas of what they are. You saw some of them in the Petoskey report, but that would be part of the discussion of this bill.
Right. Thank you. Can I follow up?
Certainly.
Thanks. And, the advantage of having British Columbia as a sort of working laboratory for some of these assumptions is useful. And I wonder, I should have asked this of Mr. Petoskey, but does British Columbia also have programs in place like the Renewable Portfolio Standard, et cetera, that their carbon tax replaced, or is... You know, if they've experienced a 15% reduction, perhaps it's 13% less than the country as a whole. Do they have the same level of other, environmental protection programs? You know, so if we're going to look at it as a laboratory,
right.
to experiment. Do we have the tools in place to look at that?
Vice Chair Johnson, Representative Dembro, I'm not an expert on British Columbia's mechanisms. My understanding, and I might be wrong on this, my understanding is this would be the first time a carbon tax has passed to then completely repeal and offset other mechanisms. I don't think that's what British Columbia has done, but I am not an expert on how they are set up. Again, trying to... start a conversation around a principled discussion. Thank you.
Representative Pence. Or Representative Whitson.
I don't know if you can answer this or if it's how it's applicable, but with a carbon tax, we would, in effect, have some trickle-down economics in Oregon. Do you know the estimated cost to the average residential electric ratepayer or gas utility user in Oregon, like per kilowatt hour per year? I would assume it would increase the cost to the average household that is a utility user from a utility that's based on a carbon-generated product.
Vice Chair Johnson, Representative Whitson, that would depend entirely on what the price in the bill. So there's a blank in the bill right now. So it would be hypothetical as to what any potential cost would be. I think it's important to remember, too, that there are other factors that are already in people's bills, whether it's, I pay a premium every month by my own choice of for green power through PGE. There are costs to regulation that are embedded within any type of price. There's also costs that are embedded through the cost of climate change and scarce water and loss of crops and all the kinds of things that happen when our climate shifts. So there's a number of costs that are embedded within that already. This would try to get a little bit more transparent as what those would be, but exactly what they are, I can't tell you until we put a number in the bill.
Could I follow up? The reason I ask is I'm simply worried about the cost to the poor of
Absolutely.
The state, and I'm not sure that this wouldn't increase the cost to those individuals who can least afford it.
Vice Chair Johnson, Representative Whitson, I absolutely share that concern, and I would seek to set this up in a way that offsets negative impacts to the poor.
Representative, I meant to ask Mr. Petoskey this, but I wonder if there's any way, whether he could or whether you've considered, if it's possible to model the impact of urban versus rural environments and how one may be disproportionately affected over the other just because of the inability to really adapt and modify behaviors in certain areas. You know, you have to drive to get to work. You have to drive to get to school. You don't have the luxury to pop onto Max or pop onto the streetcar or whatever. But is anybody that you're aware of thought about how to model that and make sure that there wouldn't be some disproportionate impact that could further impact Oregon's already impoverished economies in our rural areas?
Vice Chair Johnson, that's a great question. I would imagine that that's potentially part of modeling that could be done. I would also hypothesize that, at least the way this bill is structured, if there were dollars that were flowing from urban areas into forest offset purchases, that might be a dollar transfer from urban areas to rural areas. So I think there are definitely distributional aspects within this bill, and we could certainly look at that.
I wonder if some of your area could be a carbon storage area. You think? Sagebrush?
Yeah, right. We have no trees in Malheur County, but three. I'm looking at this, and it says 6% of the market value of oil or natural gas. If I use that 6% number roughly and use it on $4 gas, that'd be about 24 cents per gallon. Is that close to the, does this take us to that $60 per ton number that Dr. Petoskey mentioned? Do you think that 6%, is there some linkage between those, his presentation and the 6% here?
Vice Chair Johnson, Representative Bence, if so, it's coincidental. This bill was developed before I'd seen Mr. Petoskey's report, and it is not designed to intersect with his report. So I don't know exactly what dollar per ton that comes out at, but certainly possible.
His presentation reflects a fairly thoughtful, very thoughtful approach to the concept, so it would be interesting to see where that 6% fits in light of his presentation.
Absolutely.
Okay, like that's it from the panel.
Thank you.
There'll be some other panels to come up.
I guess it's next to 60.
Wow. Agnes Duncan, Irene Gilbert, and Carla K. Edwards. Yep.
Mr. Duncan.
Chair Bailey, where's the committee? Good afternoon. Nice to see you all again so soon. My name is Angus Duncan. I chair Oregon's Global Warming Commission, and in my day job, I am president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation, where, parenthetically, I deal daily in regional and national carbon markets, buy and sell carbon, including forest-sourced carbon reductions, including some from Oregon. So if I can clarify any of those issues at the end of my testimony, I'm happy to do so. I do want to first compliment Chair Bailey and Dr. Petoskey on their separate but both really major contributions to advancing the debate on carbon management and carbon reduction for the state of Oregon. As I think you've noted, our state goals would have us achieve a level of emissions 10% below what we were emitting in 1990 and do so by 2020. That's 7 years away. So the odds of getting there are steep, but the odds of getting there without making significant changes in what drives us to reduce emissions or not makes it even steeper. So it's important to start talking about issues like a carbon tax. I would like to, for the record, note that my commission's report to the legislature in 2011, which included a roadmap to 2020, list of recommendations for how we could achieve those kinds of reductions, included as recommendation MM1, advocate for a carbon price signal across the life cycle of products and materials, either by an emissions cap or a carbon tax, including on imports. That was the position that my commission unanimously took. Not being handicapped by an economics degree, as Dr. Petoskey and other local experts are, I will tell you that I generally favor the greenhouse gas certainty and the cost efficiency that I think can be achieved through a cap or a cap and trade mechanism such as has been developed and is operating in the state of California right now. I think this may be, Representative Reardon, where you were headed, and that's where I would head too. But as a practical matter, a tax or a cap, what's most important is that we move forward on one or the other. And that's true for three reasons, only two of which tend to get addressed. The first one, of course, is putting us on a downward trajectory for our carbon emissions. And the second is potentially raising additional revenue, or at least revenue from taxing a thing we don't want, carbon emissions, and using that to offset taxes elsewhere. But the third reason is one that never gets discussed, and to my mind, it's by far the most important reason, and that is that once we as a state or we as a country place a carbon target or a carbon tax out there and we say this is the world you're going to be dealing with over the next 20 or 30 or 50 years, the other thing we've done is give a signal to the economy generally and to innovative companies in particularly that if they want to make a bucket of cash, they can do so by figuring out cost-effective ways to drive down the cost of carbon reduction. We know this works because we started doing this on energy efficiency in the electrical sector 30 years ago, and the consequence of that regionally has been that we have reduced energy consumption by on the order of roughly two Grand Coulee Dam's worth of electrical energy that we do not today purchase. We don't have to go out and buy it, and we've gotten it for about a third the cost of new energy resources. And we've done that because we put a signal out there that said, here are the reductions that we think can be achieved, and businesses and inventors can figure out how to get there and make money from doing so. And we really need to give that kind of a signal to the economy as well. I want to just touch briefly on some of the issues that my commission has identified with a carbon tax. I would first say that Dr. Petoskey's analysis which is largely a macroeconomic analysis, is extremely useful in identifying those macroeconomic shifts of costs and benefits across the economy. But if we're going to do a carbon tax, we also have to identify where these are on a micro basis. And there are some fairly important issues that will have to be tackled in designing a cap and trade. Representative Bentz, Representative Vega Peterson identified competitiveness as an issue, and it is an issue, although it is an issue that's significantly attenuated by the fact that we have a southern neighbor, California, with an operating carbon cap and trade, and a northern trading partner, British Columbia, with an operating carbon tax, and a number of our international trading partners who also have various forms of carbon regulation or carbon reduction management. So it's at least as possible that the competitiveness issue will operate in the opposite direction in the not-too-distant future, and that those economies that did develop cost-efficient ways of reducing carbon are going to be at a competitive advantage compared to those that have not. And it's really important that we think about competitiveness not just statically, not just today, but that we also anticipate what future circumstances may be and how we can best position ourselves.
If I could ask you to wrap up shortly.
Sure. So it's important that we talk about ramp-in schedules for these so that we don't, so that a carbon tax is not disruptive to our economy. It is certainly important that we talk about the allocation of revenue and what the consequences of those decisions might be. Dr. Petoskey did not address the issue of electricity in the form of coal imports, or rather coal-generated electricity being imported, and we will have to figure out how we would apply a carbon tax to an imported good like electricity. That's about 25% of our overall carbon, our greenhouse gas emissions, so it's not a trivial share of this problem. We will need to look at system electrical purchases, which are not necessarily identified for their carbon content. Probably the most important issue, and the one I will close with, is that we have to look at the distributional effects of a carbon tax. Representative Whitsitt mentioned low-income households, and they certainly are at risk in a carbon tax if it's not designed appropriately to mitigate that risk. Equally are industrial companies that have energy as a very large part of their cost inputs, and therefore it's a large part of their product content. They are frequently commodities industries who operate in national and global markets where they are price takers, not price setters, and so they don't have a lot of pricing flexibility, and we have to deal with those. There are significant differences in the carbon content of electricity, whether you're a Pacific Core customer, a PGE customer, or a Eugene Water and Electric Board customer, and those issues have got to be addressed. And then Representative Johnson mentioned urban-rural issues, and I have those on my list too. I would simply say that any tax or any kind of management scheme like this is going to have distributional issues. The tax structure we have today has distributional issues. They are things that we can cope with, and we can cope with allocating them under a carbon tax as well. And so I would certainly encourage you, if the legislature in its wisdom chooses to move ahead with this bill, that part of the bill include the kind of analysis that addresses the issues that I've described. If this legislature doesn't, then I think it would be important for you to give direction to the Department of Energy or to some other entity within the government to constitute a working group to start working through some of these issues so the next legislature can have something which can detail exactly how we would cope with these. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Duncan. Before we go to our next witness, I just want to give the committee a quick heads up. We'll probably go a little bit over today. We won't be able to get through everybody on the next bill, but there are people that have come here who cannot come back that we will need to stick around to make sure that we get their testimony on the next bill, and then we'll probably hold over the remainder of that bill to the next meeting. So just to give people a sense of where we're going. Please. Thank you.
Representative Bailey. The members of the committee. I'm Irene Gilbert. Thank you for letting me speak here. And Representative Bailey, I do appreciate the fact that a lot of energy went into the verbiage of this bill. I certainly would support the elimination of the renewable energy standard, partly because, you know, when you come before a committee like this, you're happy because you brought some things, you're disgusted with yourself because of others. And one of the things that I wish I had brought is Oregon's standing when it comes to our carbon footprint, because in comparison to other states, we have a very small carbon footprint. We're way low in the state. So the efforts that we make to reduce that footprint are challenging, I guess. And as I read the bill, what I will say is what the thought that went through my mind was the devil's in the details. And I just wanted to go through a few things before I get into the rest of my comments. But as far as what the bill says, Section 1 exempts wood entirely from the carbon tax. Section 2.1b requires Oregon residents to pay a carbon tax on electricity produced out of state but sold in Oregon. Section 2.2 limits tax on oil and natural gas but not on coal. So what about clean coal and things like that? Section 2.5 gives the Department of Revenue and the Department of Energy absolutely control over how they collect the money, and so basically puts the people owing these taxes at the mercy of whatever, it says whatever rules they choose to promulgate to collect this money. Section 2.6 exempts federal agency fuel suppliers or utilities from taxes, this tax altogether, and exempts all energy produced in Oregon but sold elsewhere from the tax. And so it goes. So you can burn all the coal you want to in Oregon as long as you send the electricity out of state. This bill, as it's currently read, exempts you. One of the things that I was glad that I did bring, and I'm the one who provided the packet, is a article that came from the National Geographic Daily News. It's attachment 8. It's from May 3rd, 2012. It says, British Columbia rethinks its pioneering carbon tax. And I will not read all of it, but basically some of the quotes. The government of British Columbia is now questioning the future of the climate initiative it enacted. Talks about sectors of the community of the industry that rely heavily on the use of fossil fuels are saying that they're suffering from a lack of they're suffering in the workplace as far as selling their product. Government recently called for a comprehensive review of the carbon tax to consider constituent concerns. Another place it says, this is a good time to pause and examine how the tax is affecting our economic competitiveness. The BC Finance Minister, Kevin Falcon, in a recent budget speech said, to that end, we will carry out a comprehensive review examining the tax impacts, both positive and negative. Another place in here, it says, they recently issued a $7.6 million grant to provide compensation for agricultural growers who are negatively impacted. So enough on that. But at any rate, I encourage you to read this. Sort of the crux of my comments here are, in Oregon, hydroelectric power generation represents 58% of the power that is generated in this state, but it only represents 38.7% of the power consumed in the state due to the fact that it's transferred out of state and it's replaced by a higher carbon generating source of electricity. So we get to pay for this higher carbon electricity that we bring into the state while we're sending out hydropower that doesn't have a carbon cost to it. Fuel taxes in Oregon are only exceeded by 7 other states, and Maine has an amount equal to ours. So our fuel taxes are already high in this state. Our gasoline prices per gallon is the 12th highest in the nation. And these kinds of things obviously have impacts on our state. One thing is, we all know that low-income residents use a large percentage of their net income for things like fuel, and anytime
I could
you
ask
have,
you to just summarize your remaining comments,
okay,
that would be
quickly.
Great. Thank you.
At any rate, with business, manufacturers consume a third of the energy in this state, so they're very directly impacted. The inflated cost of energy is going to hurt drawing employers into this state. There's going to be, already Oregon has multiple rules and regulations that relate to greenhouse gases. And just in summing it up, Senate Bill 2792 will result in Oregon consumers paying a carbon tax on higher cost and higher carbon emitting energy sources, while we're sending out the cheap ones that do not have create a lot of carbon. And personally, I'm a forest owner. I'd be happy to get a bunch of money for keeping my forest going. But as far as Senate Bill 2792 is concerned, it's bad for the consumers, it's bad for business, bad for our environment, our economy, and it's bad for Oregon. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony.
Good evening, or good afternoon, it's almost evening. My name is Carla K. Edwards. I'm with Americans for Prosperity here in Oregon. And though I greatly appreciate your willingness to talk about repealing the RPS and the low carbon fuel standards, unfortunately, I still have to oppose the bill as it's written. Obviously, there is a lot of detail that is not explicitly laid out in this bill as it is. However, we're very concerned. We think that it'll have a heavier impact on rural communities and the industries of which support those rural communities, just as a straight carbon tax. We believe that it will cause a business flight, much like you've seen the cap and trade cause business flight out of California. In addition, not only is there, it would allow us to go to the maximum 6% in the Constitution for fuel and oil, but there's also, do not forget, a 3% public purpose charge already on top of our utilities. So, in fact, there would be 9% on your utilities and potentially could be calculated. That was not repealed, as far as I can see, in the bill. It will increase those to the max that possible. In addition, I want to just remind you of Oregon's state of economy. We are far below the average in annual income per household, and yet we are looking at something that would drive up the expenses here, and it's expensive to live here. So essentially what this bill would do was give citizens a choice of either higher unemployment or higher cost of living. That is a no-win question that I don't believe we should be asking our citizens to make. Again, thank you for the opportunity of even having the conversation about what the RPS and those type of things do, and I do think it's a breath of fresh air that we actually talk about the total impacts of what we're seeing on regulations. However, I want to remind you that government fees and taxes in no way are a market signal. They are a regulatory signal to a market. And so please don't think that simply by setting up something that reflects on the market, that is actually a free market signal. It is not. It is a government signal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you all very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2792. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2048. It would be very helpful to me if those who cannot come back for this hearing would let me know. Otherwise, folks, we will hold it over. So we have at least one who cannot come back. And your name, ma'am? Oh, perfect. I was going to call you up soon anyway. Anybody else who cannot come back on this? Gentlemen, may I? Mark Salins and David McCall? I had a feeling. Okay, great. So let's get started. And let's go ahead and bring up Allison Keene and Rick Bopel now. Please, whoever would like to start.
Okay, thanks. And I think DEQ is going to go first, so they may give you a little bit more history, so we might be kind of going out of order. But I'm Allison Keene. I work for the American Coatings Association and Paint Care. The American Coatings Association is basically your Washington, D.C. trade association. We represent all types of paint manufacturers, anything from what you put on your wall to what you see in the traffic marking to what you see on your furniture to the paint on your cars. PANCARE is a very specific stewardship organization that ACA incorporated just to deal with all the leftover paint that you have in your garages and your basements. It is run by a separate board, just architectural paint manufacturers, and it's open to all paint architectural paint manufacturers, so you don't have to be an ACA member to be a participant. And basically what it does is it runs stewardship programs, starting with the Oregon pilot, across the country, basically dealing with leftover paint. Why leftover paint, particularly latex paint, is usually the number one product that comes into household hazardous waste management systems, generally run by municipal governments, very costly. And about 10 years ago, we entered into a dialogue with DEQ, Portland Metro, and various different state and local governments across the country, trying to decide what to do with this. In fact, many, many different municipal governments have stopped collecting latex paint. They're telling people to dry it up, throw it out. They really just can't afford to manage it. Latex paint is 80% of the market, so it represents a very, very big portion. It's not that convenient to dry it up and throw it out. It takes a while to dry it up. If you've got kids, if you have pets, if you're in a condo or an apartment, it's just not convenient. So we came up with a model program. We basically looked at some successful programs that were ongoing in Canada, most notably BC, and we said, let's pilot that. And what you have in Oregon that we've been running for almost 3 years now is that pilot, that model pilot. Rick's here today, and he can tell you a little bit about the specific successes in Oregon, and I'll just very briefly give you a little bit more background. Why did we sponsor it 4 years ago? Why are we here saying it should be made permanent? We support a product stewardship approach to this problem. We believe that an industry-run shared approach with government, retailers, and consumers will and can be successful. We can also keep the cost at a minimum when we work with the whole market chain, and we can institute a successful program minimizing government and taxpayer costs. We want a national program, but we needed the pilot first. We believe we've achieved the success we thought we could with the pilot, and in fact, we are now operating in California. We started about 4 months ago, and we will be operating in Connecticut and Rhode Island within this year. In fact, success breeds success. I'm in 8 states this year with the legislation in Washington, Minnesota, Illinois, Texas, New York, New Jersey, Vermont, and Maine, and I literally have calls from different states almost weekly. So it's not just the PANCARE and the ACA Association that thinks this is a success. Your partners across the country think it is a success as well. In the interest of time, I'll just let you know what I've given you in the packets, and I'd be happy to answer questions. The folders have my full testimony, which has a lot more background. It has a fact sheet on the program, along with some successes that Rick is going to talk about for Oregon specifically. I also have support letters from many of my members, including Kelly Moore, Henry Company, Thayer, Valspar, Pittsburgh Paint, Sherwin-Williams, and Miller Paint. As a matter of fact, Steve Dearborn, CEO of Miller Paint, hopefully folks know Miller. They're Portland-based headquarters, and they have stores all over the Pacific Northwest. He would have loved to have been here tonight, but he had a prior engagement. I think as the bill moves forward, you'll definitely hear from him, as well as RADA. I've also handed out a hot-off-the-press final report to the American Coatings Association and Metro Oregon from the Product Stewardship Institute. This is the facilitator of the dialogue that I spoke about, that we've been coming up with a solution for almost 10 years. And it just has a wealth of great information from surveys they did about the program to HHW programs, to manufacturers, to retailers, and contractors. For the purposes of today, I just want to say that the majority of all of these folks surveyed want this program to be made permanent. We've got 54% of contractors, 65% of manufacturers, 72% of retailers, and 86% of HHW folks that were surveyed said, please make the program permanent. So in closing, I'll just mention that DEQ will mention as well that we are still working on amendments that all stakeholders can agree to, but I think we're close, and I'm positive that we'll get there, and we look forward then to bringing this program permanent to Oregon with the passage of legislation that basically gets rid of the sunset. So if you'd like to hear from Rick probably first about the Oregon, then maybe we can both take questions.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
That's great.
Okay, I'm Rick Volpel. I'm the Oregon coordinator for the program. We've been in operation for a little bit over 2 years, 2.5 years, I believe. From the start, we had 15 collection sites. 15 sites were collecting paint before paint care was in Oregon. We now have 102 collection sites around the state. 70% of these collection sites are retail paint stores. 20% are solid waste, household hazardous waste programs. And the remaining 10% are Habitat for Humanity restores. The Habitat for Humanity restores are a large outlet for reuse of paint. They actually take the paint, they screen it, and they sell it back for a lower cost to their customers. To date, we've collected over 1 million gallons of paint. We had almost a 30% increase from last year. We've also, in addition to that, recycled 60 tons of plastic containers and 66 tons of metal containers. 72% of the latex paint that we collect is actually recycled at the Metro facility into new paint. We offer a program for large volume users, what we call large volume users. Usually these are contractors of paint that have stockpiled large amounts of paint, and we will pick it up from them, do a direct pickup. So far we've collected over 30,000 gallons from these people. And that represents about 40 contractors or people that have had stockpiled paint on site. I have lots of stories about those folks. That's all I have right now.
Thank you. Would it be fair to say, and I heard you say, express your support for extending or for removing the sunset. I know that we are going to hear through the submission of a couple of at least conceptual amendments at this point. We will have them in written form soon, that there are still some outstanding policy decisions, I would say, for the committee to make, but that in general you are fully supportive of this program moving forward, pending a resolution of a few policy details. Is that a fair summary?
Correct, yes.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt.
I was just wondering if you could just briefly say what do you see are the advantages of this bill over the present statute? Is it the sunset?
Correct. The major issue that we want to do is make the program permanent. The sunset would basically make it, you know, go away. I think the idea of the amendments is that this really was a pilot. The first statute was very open. We were learning what we were doing. DEQ was learning what they're doing. Metro, everybody involved. I think we obviously know much better now, and we can put some more specifics into that statute to clearly identify the roles and responsibility for all the stakeholders, and that's what we're attempting to do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Interesting program, and I'm thinking it's working, but I'd like to know the cost per can, mm-hmm. per gallon of paint recycled that wasn't brought into the program before this started.
I don't have the numbers. You probably...
I can give you a guess.
Okay.
From my rough estimate. You can tell me how wrong I am or not, Mr. Chair, if I may. The guess is the program costs about $4 million. The amount of paint recycled is about 1 million gallons. That's $4 a gallon. About half of that paint was already coming in. That takes it to $8 a gallon. That's what we're paying, I think, to get the paint recycled, about $8 a gallon. And my question would be, prove that that's wrong, and then show us that whatever we're paying per gallon to get this stuff recycled is worth me going, being approached in Baker City as I was, and being asked why we didn't impose a 75-cent per gallon tax on paint. And I was without an answer, so I need an answer.
Okay, so if I understand the question hopefully correctly, I know what our costs are to manage a gallon paint. I'm just not sure what those were prior to the program. I believe if you ask Metro or DEQ, they probably were 8 and above. We are at $6 a gallon. The first year we were about 7. We're now down to 6. So we are making consistent progress in making those costs as low as possible, gaining efficiencies by our contracts, transport, and processing. I can't speak for what exactly it was prior to the program, but we have reduced those costs since we've put the program in place.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And those numbers are in this report.
Yeah, the thing that's the most important to me that I see, I haven't read the report closely enough, but I don't know if I have seen or if there is in that report what your costs are, so that I can tell when you say costs exactly what those that list is. That's important to me.
Sure, absolutely. We actually have an independent financial audit once a year that we submit. It's publicly available. It's online, www.paintcare.org. You can click on Oregon and get it. And they, that basically is an outside CPA firm that does the audit, lists all our costs, breaks it out by, you know, administration, communications, processing, transportation, et cetera, and then that's where we take, you know, here's all the revenue, here's what we spent, so then here's the total cost per gallon of recycled content paint.
Final question, and it is simply that I'm checking in other states to see what it costs to recycle a gallon of paint, and I don't know if it's $6, $2, $8, I have no idea, but we're checking on that now. So we can compare and see if this is a good deal for the folks in the state of Oregon.
I think that's that's great. I think that's very important.
I hope you'll share that with the committee representative.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was wondering, in Tillamook, you don't have a collector. They're still collecting it at the hazardous waste stuff, but they still, in Tillamook County, they still pay the fee at the store when they buy the paint. So where does their money go?
So Tillamook, the HHW Center, is one of our collectors. They're under contract with us.
Which was it? Which
Tillamook's HHW program is. So we don't just do paint care only. We start first and foremost with the HHW infrastructure you had in place. And one of the primary reasons for this is to reduce their costs. So if they're collecting and they're collecting in the paint care program, we now pay for all the transportation and disposal. We pay for the collection bins, the spill kits, the training, everything. All they have to do is say, ooh, latex paint, put it in the paint care bucket, and we'll take care of it. Then we start to go out to our retail community trying to get more convenient infrastructure so that if you can only go to Tillamook once every Saturday, now you can go to your True Value down the street 7 days a week retail hours. So we started out paying for the current infrastructure, and then we added to that infrastructure with our retail partners.
So, Paula?
Please.
So you can, if you buy it, say at Lumberman's or something, you can take it back to Lumberman's?
It, well, I don't know what lumber, I'd have to look to see whether it's our paint care collection site, but yes, the idea is that if you bought it at a Miller paint store, you can bring it back to that Miller paint store. Frankly, you can bring it back to a Sherwin-Williams store. You know, if it's a paint care location, you can bring whatever paint you bought back to that location, and that includes your HHW municipal centers.
That's interesting. We can follow up on this some more, having tried to bring paint back to a Miller paint store, the main Miller paint store, and been denied. I think some issues in trying to figure out exactly where we can and cannot return our paint. Representative Whitsitt.
Does that include stain also?
Yes, it does.
The transparent stains?
Correct. So any architectural paint, whether it's latex or oil-based, stain, decking, flooring coatings, pretty much anything you think of as, you know, house paint.
So is there a limit to how much you can take back to the store?
There is no limit, but it's interesting, Mr. Chair. I would love to know about why they didn't take it back, whether it's just because they weren't participating or whether they were overstocked and we needed to get a pickup or what happened there. But there is no limit except for that in some cases the retail stores, given the size that they have to store these containers in the room, they may limit you to 5 gallons a week or, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. Or like Rick said, if you have a ton, we will then go and we'll pick it up from you so that you don't overwhelm a retail store or an HHW center.
Could I have your number?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, my card.
Maybe
is,
the chair would like
my
it
card
too.
Is in the packet. Okay. But I would ask, and Steve Dearborn would be the first person to say from Miller Paint what happened, and let's make sure that it doesn't happen again. The other thing I would just mention is we are working very hard on our locator. So we were outsourcing that. We're now insourcing it. So hopefully in the next, by April 1st, in the next month or so, we will not only have a very new site locator, so it would be easier for you guys to find our folks within your state or, frankly, even in California, if you want to go there, to return your paint. And we'll have a mobile app, and we're just getting really high tech at that. So we are working on that, and I think we'll have a better solution in the next month or so.
Thank you. Any burning questions? We have two gentlemen who cannot come back next time who we need to bring up as well. Vice Chair Johnson.
I could just ask them maybe and get the responses offline, but I'm trying to delve into understanding the cost and how that figure comes about. So if you can help me, I see DEQ establishes by rural and so forth, makes some determination, what the fees end up being and so forth. I just love to know how that cost is determined, and if more participants can drive that cost down or not, just via economies of scale. The other question I have, and you can get back to me on this too, as we talk about it, I see in the bill it says there must be at least one location per county, and then there's also some language in here about per population and so forth as well. Some counties in the state could be, you know, there's a lot of...
Pose some challenges.
Yeah, I mean, as we, the nature of this committee obviously being carbon focused as we are, you get a pretty significant carbon footprint taking back that 1 gallon of paint, which might be a little bit defeating our purpose here. So I'm just would like a little background on maybe where exactly we have them located now officially and what the potential is for increasing that if in fact we're going to obviously maintain this program. It needs to be to the beneficial of those folks that are actually paying at the pump, so to speak, for the cost of that. So you can get back to me as you're able to.
Correct. Well, I mean, very quickly, the way that we derive the costs, we're a nonprofit, so we just want to cover the cost of the program administration, collecting, transporting, processing, education and outreach, which is a big component, communications. We basically came in and estimated the revenue, how many gallons, how many 5 gallons, how many quarts, and what we thought we would make off the program, and then we estimated how much we thought was going to cost based on our RFPs out to a Portland Metro for processing or a PSC for transportation or what have you. And then we literally divided and we figured, well, if it's going to cost us this much based on how many containers we sell, this is how much we need to make to cover the cost of the program. And I think so far we've been doing a great job. But you're right, the economies of scale, and as we get better and better, we can reduce those costs. And as we start to see a surplus, we can actually drive that 75 cents or 35 cents, whatever it is, down. We just go back to DEQ and get approval for doing that. As far as collection coverage, we are working on amendment for that. We do want to make it convenient. It is much more difficult in the rural areas, obviously, to balance not only the carbon footprint, but if you don't have a paint store and you don't have an HHW program, how do we provide that service? To date, we've been doing paint care only events. We're looking for a little tighter language to make sure that not only do the rural areas get serviced, but also the heavily populated areas get serviced more too. So, for example, if you have one permanent facility within a 15-mile radius, that's great, but all of Portland Metro is in a 15-mile radius. So that's, you know, and you've got 1.2 or 1.5 million, how many people? So we're working on that. That's going to be one of the amendments, and I think it's incredibly important to make sure that both the rural and the populated areas are taken care of as far as collection.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your time and your travel out here.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks
Thank
for
you.
Thanks for allowing us to go today.
Absolutely. And call up Laura Liebrich, Mark Salins, and David McCall, please. Thank you, committee, for your patience. We appreciate it. And thank you, gentlemen, for your patience in being here for so long. Please.
Good afternoon, Chair Bailey, members of the committee, and staff. For the record, my name is Laura Liebrich, and I'm the Governmental Affairs Director for Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association. ORA and its members have participated in the Paint Product Stewardship Pilot Program discussion since the first bill was considered and passed in 2009. We've devoted time and effort to interim discussions and offered suggestions for improvement of the pilot program. DEQ also summarized the needed improvements to the pilot program in its 2011 report to the legislature. Most of the necessary corrections are included in House Bill 2048, and ORA agrees with much of the bill. However, not all of the corrections noted in the 2011 report were incorporated into House Bill 2048, and therefore, as drafted and in its current form, ORA is opposed to the bill. ORA has suggested some amendments to the bill, and those have been submitted to Legislative Council. However, the amendments were not ready in time for this hearing. If those amendments were to be adopted, ORA would move to supporting the bill. Conceptually, there are three amendments, and they are designed to do the following. Require that there's complete cost recovery for all collection costs. Allow for cities and counties to have the option to offer premium service collection programs for paint if the local ratepayers are willing to bear those costs. And extend the pilot program status of the law until 2018. Briefly, here are the reasons ORA supports these three conceptual amendments. First, require that there's complete cost recovery for all collection costs. Since the implementation of the pilot program began in 2010, ORA and its members have consistently asked that the pilot program meet its statutory requirement to, quote, cover the cost of collecting, transporting, and processing the post-consumer architectural paint managed through a statewide architectural paint stewardship pilot program, end quote. Currently, over 60% of the paint collected pursuant to this pilot program is delivered to county household hazardous waste programs and to solid waste collection companies, which make up 19% of the paint take-back locations in the state. Paint Care has refused to pay any of the collection costs incurred by those programs prior to the point where Paint Care picks up the collected paint for transport and ultimate disposition. The pilot program law requires that the paint assessment, which is the amount added to the purchase price of architectural paint sold in Oregon, will cover the cost of collection, but it is not doing so. Therefore, those costs are borne by ratepayers, and they could be paying twice for the paint take-back, once when they pay the fee upon paint purchase, and again through their solid waste collection service bills or through their taxes. Additionally, for people who are not consumers of paint, they are paying to help subsidize the collection of paint through their garbage rates. The conceptual amendment will require Paint Care to reimburse those counties and companies' costs as envisioned in the pilot program originally. Second, allow for cities and counties to have the option to offer premium service. Collection programs for paint, premium service collection programs for paint if the local ratepayers are willing to bear those costs.
Interrupt you for a second and say, if we have this submitted to us, we can read these conceptual amendments. I want to make sure these gentlemen get a chance to testify as well. So you could summarize your remaining comments. That would be great. Thank you.
Summarize, just shorten things up.
Correct. Okay. That would be great. Thank you.
All right. Third, extend the pilot program status of the law until 2018. Oregon's paint pilot program is the first in the nation, and as a result, many other states are watching how it works. It's a pilot program for the very practical reason that the legislature recognized it would likely require amendment before considering making it permanent. House Bill 2048 seeks to correct a number of the issues that have arisen during this pilot, and ORA's conceptual amendments are designed to cover the rest. I think that's about it. Thanks for your time and consideration, and I'm happy to take any questions you might have.
Thank you very much, and thanks for submitting that as well. We'll read it carefully.
Yep.
Gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. I very much appreciate you taking the time to hear our testimony so we don't have to try to travel back. My name is Mark Salins, and I am the chair of the Solid Waste Subcommittee of the Association of Oregon Counties, AOC. My day-to-day job, I work as the program manager for the Lincoln County Solid Waste District, so I've driven over from Lincoln County today. First off, we would like to commend DEQ for involving key stakeholders in this model legislation to effectively handle the disposition of unused architectural paints in Oregon. Their staff has worked hard over the last 3 years to monitor, evaluate, and now craft new requirements for an ongoing paint collection program, as we've been hearing throughout the day, commonly referred to as Paint Care. Prior to this legislation, many local governments, such as my own, we spent a great deal of time dealing with unused paints, and it was very expensive. However, as good as the submitted permanent program, House Bill 2448 is, it's the opinion of the AOC that the paint stewardship program should move forward as an extended pilot program for the following reasons. Reason number one, reporting transparency. The pilot program does propose more specific language that would direct the stewardship organization to provide additional details for plan submittals and for annual reports to DEQ. It would require more specific financial information and development of a standardized metric for the paint collection. Unfortunately, this has been a struggle at many of our stakeholder meetings over the last 3 years, and I guess the statement we'd like to say is we're hopeful that that will happen, but it remains to be seen whether that will really be effective. So that underscores one reason why we'd like to continue the pilot program. As was mentioned by Laura, monetary compensation at the local level is a big concern. One of the original goals, as you heard, was to unburden local governments from the cost of dealing with paint. Local governments in this case not only include cities and counties, but whoever they contract with, their waste and recycling companies, to haul away. And to repeat what you've already heard, according to DEQ's report, 62% of this paint is still initially collected, touched by local haulers. There is no monetary compensation for that. So in essence, what you're seeing in terms of the total cost of the program isn't even including, you know, dozens of people around the state that are taking that paint, putting it in totes, and so forth. Convenient collection opportunity, I know that's been hit on quite a bit, so I'm just going to emphasize the fact that we aren't really satisfied with coverage as it currently exists. And then one final point is education and outreach. Throughout the 3 years of stakeholder meetings, we continuously were getting stories where you'd go into your local paint store, much like it was mentioned by committee today, they would have no idea that such a program even existed. So that's one area that really has to have some attention. And again, I would hate to assume that we've killed that bird the proper way in terms of a permanent program. To wrap up, for the four reasons stated above, AOC believes a continuation of the pilot program would be the best route for making improvements to a paint stewardship program. We can endorse that as a model for effective paint collection and of unused paint. However, as I've outlined, there's still significant concerns. If the bill did move forward in a permanent fashion, then every effort should be made by DEQ to monitor success in these four critical areas. And there should be a mechanism, including continuation of the stakeholder meetings that have been so successful in the past, to assist DEQ in monitoring the success of this new permanent program should it go that direction. And most importantly, there should be a mechanism built in so that if the success that was intended does not occur, there's a way of basically fixing that midterm rather than having to wait till, you know, some other time. So in summary, again, AOC supports a paint stewardship program, but feels at this time that the pilot program is really the best way to go in terms of continuing things. We did have a discussion, I just wanted to mention very briefly, of the amendments being brought forward by ORA. We don't necessarily oppose those. We simply had not had an opportunity to look at them yet. And the way we understand it, many of our concerns are addressed in those amendments. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Sir.
Chair Bailey and members of the committee, my name is David McCall, and I'm the Solid Waste Program Manager for Tillamook County. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to come here today and share with you a few experiences that Tillamook County has had with the Paint Stewardship Program. I have prepared a very short handout for you, and I will try to be very concise. Tillamook County is a bit of a unique situation in that at about the time the paint stewardship program was being introduced, Tillamook County ventured into constructing a permanent household hazardous waste collection facility. This is the only such facility on the Oregon coast, and especially important for a rural community. Up until that time, we'd been having annual hazardous waste collection events. Since the completion of that facility, we've gone to regular, almost every month, collection events. I chose this. If we look at the past, we have very similar numbers for past years. I chose the year 2007 just out of as an average. You'll see during that year we had 48,267 pounds of paint, 24 tons of paint, and also paint related material, which were all paid, collected and paid for. We had 30.5 tons of household hazardous waste total. So the paint accounted for about 60%, 62% of the household hazardous waste we had. That cost us $76,000 that year. So also in an answer to Representative Benz's previous question, if I may, looking at those numbers, our collection and hauling disposal costs were about $1 per pound for our household hazardous waste. Now, that's true. It's not only paint there. It's also thermometers and other items. But on the we don't have any way of separating the collection costs for different items. And so if you take a broad average, $1 per pound and 8 pounds per gallon of paint, we're at about $8 per gallon, which was our collection and treatment costs. Now, since we have the facility completed, it was completed in 2011, and the first full year was 2012. In that year, we saw a 58% increase in the quantities of paint, which we accepted at the facility. That year, we took in 38 tons of paint and paint-related material. It's important to mention the paint-related material because they're not covered by the paint care program, but they weren't a separate category beforehand because it was all treated alike. Our total quantities of household hazardous waste increased by 47%. So the increase in paint was more than the overall average. But our cost for collecting and treating all these materials actually went down by 8.5%. But we're still at nearly $70,000 a year. And that's for the collection. We have not been reimbursed by anyone for the collection of these materials, nor for the treatment. Paint Care has taken over the hauling and treatment of paints handled under their program. Everything else is still coming out of the county's budget. So on the one hand, we're very thankful that the Paint Care programs helped us, because I think it's very rare in an economy, as we see, when things are much harsher than they were 5 years ago. We have 58% more material to take care of, but we actually reduced our costs by 8.5%. For us, the most important piece of this legislation would be a recuperation, or at least a partial recuperation, of the collection costs, which we see every month. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the helpful testimony. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much for traveling. It must have been very clear.
Thank you.
We'll be sure to review the written information that you gave us. Thank you very much for your testimony. We're going to hold over the remainder of the hearing on House Bill 2048. Apologies to those rest of the people that were signed up to testify. So we will take this up on Tuesday, and we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2048. And anything for the good of the order? Thank you, committee. Appreciate the patience. Committee is adjourned.